From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Fresh Air will bring you a series of special programs on the war in the Gulf, beginning with the next edition of our show. But today we bring you interviews from our archives. Coming up, poet and novelist Mae Sarton reflects on a life of solitude. Also, Mercer Ellington talks about growing up as Duke's son and conducting the Duke Ellington Orchestra since his father's death in 1974. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The question of whether or not Israel would retaliate for the overnight Iraqi missile attack dominated most of today's diplomatic activity. Leaders of the multinational coalition are worried that an Israeli attack could cause disaffection among the Arab nations in the alliance. Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Aaron said today that his country would retaliate, but he made it clear that Israel would choose its own time and place. Egypt provided some reassurance today that it will stick with the alliance even if Israel does retaliate. Secretary of State James Baker talked by telephone again to Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, and all the ambassadors in Washington were invited to the State Department for a briefing. Barry Schwide has more from the State Department.
The ambassadors were given a report on the Gulf War by Assistant Secretary of State John Kelly. Only the Iraqi ambassador was not invited. Secretary of State Baker, meanwhile, had the Saudi ambassador, Prince Bandar, in, and Baker telephoned Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. Little was said about all this activity, but it obviously dealt with Israel's assertion of a right to defend itself against Iraq. In that regard, Israel got a boost from its only Arab peace partner, Egypt. Syed El-Ridi, the Egyptian ambassador, said Egypt is solidly in the coalition against Iraq. Asked if Egypt would bolt if Israel retaliated, El-Ridi replied, "Don't worry about it." For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
So far today, there have been two air raid alerts in Israel as intelligence sources detected indications that another Iraqi missile attack might be on its way. No attack materialized. Israeli radio reported that the second alert may have been triggered by the fiery disintegration of a Soviet satellite. Last night, air raid sirens were also heard in Dahran, Saudi Arabia, and in the neighboring nation of Bahrain. At a base in central Saudi Arabia, Radio Pool reporter John Bascom describes the alerts that appear to be becoming a nightly event.
For two nights in a row at about 3 a.m., the siren has gone off to indicate that this base is about to be hit by a Scud missile. People wake up very fast and race each other to put on chemical protective clothing. But no missiles have fallen. That doesn't alleviate the anxiety that is growing here every night, especially since Israel has been hit. Some people now sleep in their chemical suits, a heavy jacket and pants. And the early morning wake-up call is getting to be a part of the daily routine. The alert is either yellow for warning or red for imminent danger. And now some of the troops have an expression of hope or encouragement. They say to each other at the end of the day, "No bad colors tonight." John Bascom at an airbase in central Saudi Arabia.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained just over 23 points today to close at 2,646.78. Added to yesterday's 115-point jump, today's figure brought the Dow to a record weekly gain. This is NPR. Iraq now claims to have shot down 94 Allied warplanes since the beginning of the multinational assault. The official Iraqi news agency claimed that 22 more Allied planes were shot down today. Allied commanders have reported so far that 8 multinational aircraft have been lost. That includes the loss of 4 U.S. warplanes, 2 British fighter bombers, and 1 plane each from the Kuwaiti and Italian air forces. Senior Pentagon officials say they're pleased with results of the Persian Gulf War so far, but that the U.S. and Allied forces haven't yet achieved air superiority. Army General Tom Kelly and Navy Rear Admiral John McConnell are officers of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They spoke with reporters several hours ago. Admiral McConnell was asked about the effectiveness of the Allied assault on the Iraqi Air Force.
The airplanes that we suspect have been down so far include MiG-29s, probably French Mirage F-1s, and a couple of other airplanes suspected damage probably on the ground. So it looks like eight engaged and down in the air. That's an uncertain figure, as you might imagine. There's a lot of ambiguity, uncertainty related with it, and so we're still sorting that out.
Admiral McConnell says Iraq has a sophisticated air defense system by Western standards, but that it hasn't been as well executed as U.S. officials had predicted. Cable News Network reported today that five of its reporters left Baghdad, along with four from the Canadian Broadcasting Company and one from the Associated Press. The journalists headed for the Jordanian border in a four-car convoy. Included in the convoy were CNN's anchorman Bernard Shaw and correspondent John Holloman and the CBC's Eric Rankin. International shipping analysts say that the oil tanker market has been thrown into confusion by the Gulf War. E.A. Gibson, a major London shipping broker, said tankers operating in the Gulf are able to boost their rates, but businesses that charter them have to absorb additional insurance. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today's edition of our show features interviews from the archives. Let me explain our thinking behind that. In many places around the country, we're preempted today for expanded news coverage of the war. Beginning with the next edition of Fresh Air, we will be part of NPR's expanded coverage of the war. But what we have for you today is an interview with Mae Sarton, recorded in 1989. Mae Sarton has become a heroic figure to many of her readers because she's had the courage to go her own way. Sarton is 78 now, and since she was 45, she's chosen to live the life of solitude. She's chronicled that life in a series of journals that have inspired her readers to reflect on their lives as she has reflected on hers. Her recent journals describe aging alone and recovering from a mild stroke at her home in Maine. Sarton's latest novel is about a 60-year-old woman who, for the first time, comes out publicly as a lesbian. It was in 1965, after writing several novels about married protagonists, that Sarton came out. She says, "On the surface, my work has not looked radical, but perhaps it will be seen eventually that in a nice, quiet way, I've been trying to say radical things gently so that they may penetrate without shock." Most of the letters Sarton gets are from women and men who relate to her writing about solitude, and it's with solitude that our interview began.
Well, I've always needed a lot of it. You see, I was an only child. My father, a scholar who was very concentrated on his work, my mother, an artist. That is, even in my family life, I was a solitary. I loved other children. I mean, I'd rush off to school early in the morning. It's not that, but solitude has always been a necessity for me, partly because I think I believe this is true of everybody. You really only experience something when you have the chance to sit down and think about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've said that without solitude, you feel you lose your center.
Yes, that's right. Because your center, after all, is made out of your thinking about what has happened to you. It's, I think, and it's constantly being remade. But if you're too much clutter, it's just what I feel about my house right now. There's so many little things. I'm just going to get rid of the clutter. And that's what solitude does for you.
Now, how remote is your home?
Well, it's not really very remote, but there's nobody within. If I was attacked, nobody would hear me scream. It looks down a lovely field to the ocean, and what you hear all night is that sighing of the ocean. And when I first came there, I used to think that there was a train going by somewhere, and then I'd realize it was the ocean.
Do you worry about being attacked?
No.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one, I'm a fatalist, and two, this is a very remote place, and three, it seems a very benign town. I mean, it's hard to imagine something violent happening there.
Mm-hmm.
When I first came, I did get some threats, but that was a private vendetta against me by some people. And that was frightening when I got a note saying, you know, enjoy it now, we're going to get you, and things like that.
Yeah.
But then I went to the post office, I went to any shops or cleaners, that kind of thing, florist, and said, told them the situation, and said, never tell anybody where I live. It's rather hard to find, and nobody has found it. So that's really worked very well.
Mm-hmm. As much as you like solitude, you've also called it your self-imposed solitary confinement. And in your journals, really, there's really quite a bit about depression.
Oh, yes. Well, I think it's inevitable if you're a writer, a serious writer. There's bound to be some depression. You can't every day get up and say, I'm a genius and everything's great. I mean, you're fighting something all the time. You're a lot of the time you're in conflict. And some of the writing certainly comes out of that. For instance, my novel, Anger. Anger has been a constant in my life. I'm an angry temperament in some ways. And I wanted to get at that. And so I really wrote the novel to find out myself what it was all about. And this is what my writing is anyway. It's a lot of the time is to find out what I really feel, what I really think about something.
A lot of your readers identify so strongly with your writing and I think even want to be you. And you've said that there's something wrong when solitude such as yours can be envied by a happily married woman. Why?
Did I say that?
Yes, you did in one of the journals.
Because I don't remember that, because I think it's fairly natural. In other words, there are these opposites in all of us. There's a part of me which would love to have a large family and now be a grandmother. It's just that we are all such a bundle of opposites, I think.
I know exactly what you mean.
You know, that's really it. But then I am certainly dedicated in the sense that there is one thing in my life that I would give up everything else for, and that is my work.
Your writing.
My writing.
And
yes.
My guest is writer Mae Sarton. You've said that we have to make myths of our lives, and I think in a way you're making a myth of your life through always writing journals.
Yes, although I started very late on that. You have to have an image of yourself which is viable for you. And my image of myself does have to do with solitude. There's no doubt about that. And then the enormous response to the journals, which are written, of course, in solitude and are mostly about the sort of sacred routines. Sacred is an odd word, but I really believe this to be true. And somebody compared me to the painter Vermeer recently in a thesis they were writing, because it was the sacramental of the ordinary. You remember the Vermeer women who are nearly always writing a letter or sewing or doing something very feminine and concentrated. And the magic of these paintings, of course, is the light. But also the fact that we carry away an image of something very feminine, which is very precious. And I use even the word sacred. So I think, for instance, that if you can make dishwashing a sort of a ritual which has meaning for you. It's a tremendous advance. And this is what I try to do with my life.
Does writing journals help you think of your life in that way?
It does, but of course I'd thought all those things long before. You see, I started my first journal, I think, when I was 60.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was late in my life. My life was shaped then. And it was an experiment because I was very depressed. And I thought, if I can write about this, maybe I can solve it. It was an unhappy love affair that I was involved in. And in fact, in that book, the lover is X, neither man nor woman. I'm a little braver now than I was then.
Has your view of solitude changed as you get older?
Yes. I think it has in one sense, and that is that friends are very, very precious because I can't work as much. And because of heart trouble that I now have, it's not serious. I'm not going to die of it. But it makes me unable to work for weeks at a time. And then I realize how precious the friends are who can come and talk and be with me. Whereas I really haven't needed that very much until now. And I think that is something of the beginning of old age. But there's also solitude, you see.
Well, you know, I think that for a lot of people, the greatest fear is the fear of being old alone.
Yes.
And the greater fear is of dying alone.
Yes, I can see that very clearly. I'd like to die alone. I mean, I think it would be easier than perhaps having people around. But we all have death in our minds. I mean, after about 60, certainly, I think you can't escape that. I have the feeling, and I've said so in the journals, that we grow towards death, and it's the last great adventure, and we have to be prepared for it. So that I find being old in some ways very exciting, in other ways very limiting, and therefore, I get cross and I get depressed because I can't do things that I want to do anymore, like gardening.
You had a stroke a few years ago,
yes.
And you have a journal about recovering
from
the stroke. You were alone when you were stricken. How did you cope with that? How did you cope with getting
to the
hospital?
Well, I waited until 6 o'clock because I didn't want to bother anybody. At six, I called a friend of mine who's an RN and said, Janice, I think I've had a slight stroke. And she said, call the doctor at once. I'm coming right away. We'll get an ambulance. And the whole thing began. But you see, it was, luckily, a slight stroke. I was able to pack my suitcase, but I wasn't able to get my breakfast. And it was the left side. You see, that's where I'm so lucky, because if it had been the right side, I wouldn't be able to speak, probably. And I write about what it affected. It was very strange what goes on in your head. I mean, for about a year, I felt quite crazy. All the past just flowed through me, and I couldn't escape it. I was pursued by images of my whole life. So thank God that isn't happening now. And I think I'm now fairly well, and they keep tabs on the possibility of another stroke, of course. I mean, you take medicine and things.
You have a poem with you. Would you read that for us?
Yes, and this fits in, I think, quite well with what we've been talking about. It's the title poem of my last book of poetry, which was called The Silence Now. These days, the silence is immense. It is there deep down, not to be escaped. The twittering flight of goldfinches, the three crows cawing in the distance, only brush the surface of this silence, full of mourning, the long drawn-out tug and sigh of waters never still, the ocean out there and the inner ocean. Only animals comfort, because they live in the present and cannot drag us down into those caverns of memory full of loss. They pay no attention to the thunder of distant waves. My dog's eager eyes watch me as I sit by the window thinking. At the bottom of the silence, what lies in wait? Is it love? Is it death? Too early or too late? What is it I can have that I still want? My swift response is to what cannot stay. The dying daffodils, peonies on the way, iris just opening, lilac turning brown in the immense silence where I live alone. It is the transient that touches me, old, those light-shot clouds as the sky clears. A passing glory can still move to tears, moments of pure joy like some fairy gold, too evanescent to be kept or told, and the cat's soft footfall on the stair keeps me alive, makes nowhere into here. At the bottom of the silence, it is she who speaks of an eternal now to me.
What a nice poem. You know, and I should mention that you write so much about your cats and dogs that you've had in your books.
Yes. They're very dear companions.
Yeah. Let me ask you, in 1982, you wrote out a check to a retirement community for them to hold for 5 years from then when you planned on joining. Whatever
yes.
happened with that?
Well, I discovered the people I really wanted to be with, the former dean of the faculty at Wellesley was one of them, would be about 100 by the time I was 80 and going there. So I figured that it wasn't a good idea. And then when I went to see them, I found being in the dining room with nothing but gray heads and nothing but people on the way out. I mean, having difficulty in walking as I do now and all these things, that I found it terribly depressing. And so I canceled it. It's also quite expensive. I'm determined now to die where I am, in a house that I rent from good friends and right on the sea. And when the time comes, it would be cheaper probably to have a live-in housekeeper than to go to a retirement community. But you never know. I mean, what if I have another stroke? You just have to sort of take a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Live your life and hope it'll end well.
We're listening to an interview recorded in 1989 with writer Mae Sarton. On the next edition of Fresh Air, we'll join NPR's expanded coverage of the war in the Gulf. More with Mae Sarton after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. We're featuring an interview from the Fresh Air Archives with writer Mae Sarton. It was recorded in 1989, after the publication of her novel, The Education of Harriet Hatfield. Let me see if I can describe this novel a little bit. It's about a 60-year-old woman whose companion of 30 years has just died, and the companion has left her an inheritance with which she opens a women's bookstore. And she's being interviewed by a newspaper reporter, and the newspaper reporter asks her if she's a lesbian, and she says that, yes, she is. And that's kind of the headline in the article. the headline is, Lesbian Bookstore Owner Threatened. So suddenly she's kind of public and out, and after living a pretty isolated life, she finds herself in the middle of the lesbian feminist community. The novel is in a way about generational differences, I think, between older women and younger women who are lesbians. Do you see it that way?
Well, in some ways, yes, of course. The point about her coming out as a lesbian is that she is threatened, and that it isn't that she's sudden, that she's... people attack her because the bookstore is not like what they are used to in a somewhat blue-collar neighborhood. So that the book is about homophobia, mm-hmm. Really. It's about how strange it is that so much hatred and violence can be created just by the presence of, in this case, a very discreet elderly lady who opens a bookstore. But we see these things happening all the time. And every incident in the book of violence is something I know happened. So, I mean, that's what I wanted. I wanted to try to say, look, I mean, here we are. We're just ordinary people, just like you. We have the same problems. We're not monsters. We're not... That's what I was trying to get at. And I'm happy because I had a letter yesterday from somebody saying, Harriet is adorable. This really took me by surprise. But you've created such a marvelously warm and funny and character, which is, of course, what I was hoping somebody would say, but so rarely happens.
Well, let me ask you a few things about Harriet and how, if at all, she relates to the way you've lived your life. She's a woman who is 60 at the time of the novel, and she was never really publicly out before. She never really related to other women couples, hated the term lesbian because it seemed like such a primarily sexual word. Does that describe you at all?
I think it describes a great many people, and not only people my age. I think it describes a great many women who are living together and who somewhat shudder at the word lesbian. And it's beginning now to come out. In the book I have, and this really happened to me, mm-hmm. it happens to me all the time, a young woman introduced somebody and said, this is my lover. Well, you see, this does take me aback, but it's done all the time now, men also. There you're right, there is a generation gap, but I think Harriet somewhat really does jump over it in one way or another.
Oh, she definitely does.
Yes.
And do you feel that you have too?
Yes, but I think it's very difficult. I mean, I don't think it's easy to come out in front of an audience of 1,000 people and say I'm a lesbian and proud of it. But I do that, but I do it with difficulty. I mean, the homosexual community is a community which is on the whole not liked. You are a little segment that is. So it's not easy. I think it's wrong to say that it's easy. And I think if this book has a value, it's that in a way it takes this not easy thing with perfect honesty and not minimizing it, but rather lightly at the same time, so that you don't put it down. You read it fast and laugh sometimes. That's what I hope.
Now, in 1965, you wrote a novel called Mrs. Stevens Hears the Mermaid Singing.
Yes.
And this was the first novel you wrote that had a lesbian protagonist in it.
It was actually a novel in which I came out, I think. Mm-hmm. I think that's fairly agreed to now. Got almost no good reviews, but is now a classic. It's taught in all the women's studies, the colleges. This is very nice, you know, to know that something that you wrote at a time. My agent, Dermot Russell, one of the best in New York, he's dead now, alas. But, I mean, he said, don't publish it, May, it's going to do you harm. And I said, Dermot, let me give it first to my publishers, to Norton, and if they don't like it, all right. But they did.
The novel wasn't well-reviewed at the time,
yes,
when it came out in 1965. But how did coming out affect your career as a writer?
Well, I lost two jobs right away. One was to be head of a big public school poetry series in the summer, in summer school in Philadelphia. And they told me, we just feel that this is government money and it might, you know, come out that you were what you are. And so that was the first. And then Christian Science Monitor was doing a series on poetry, which I wrote an essay for, which was to open the series. And they said they couldn't open the series. That wasn't quite as bad with me. But, you know, you pay a price even now.
Mm-hmm. When the gay rights movement came along, did you identify or were you alienated from it initially?
I think neither, mm-hmm. because I had already come out, and also I had already made for myself a very solitary life, which was not political, so that it's not in my kind of life to march, for instance. I'm rather ashamed of this. I wish I wanted to. But I think you have to be what you are and not pretend that you're something else.
Well, I think that's a really good point. And it seems strange to me that you'd be kind of embarrassed because, after all, what people love so much about your writing has to do with the life of solitude that you've led.
Well,
and you,
yes.
You really can't have it both ways.
No, that's true.
You wrote a poem a few years ago called Myself to Me. And in your introduction to the poem, you said, "I wrote this poem when I thought I was too old to love. That was some years ago. I learned better."
Yes.
Do you still feel that way, that there's, you know...
Oh, yes. Well, I think that there's always the possibility of a person coming into one's life who excites the waters, so to speak, who makes everything happen again. For a poet, you have to have a muse. Now, when you're 77, of course, it's not the easiest thing in the world to conceive of one arriving, but I never despair.
Can I ask you to read another poem?
Yes, I'd be glad to. This is a very short one, which was written for a friend of mine who's since died. But this is really about what it is to be a poet. It's called The Skilled Man, for Bill Vaughan. If someone should ask me how a poem is whittled and willed, just how it is done, you know, with what love, both wary and skilled, I'd suggest that he watch Bill make a thing that does not look hard, like the staff for an old knife, and learn that all that it takes to make a knife new or a word is the subtle exchange of a life.
May Sarton, I want to thank you so much for talking with us and for reading some of your poems. Thank you.
Thank you.
Writer May Sarton, her latest novel is The Education of Harriet Hatfield. On the next edition of Fresh Air, we begin a series of special programs on the war in the Gulf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Beginning with the next edition of Fresh Air, we will be part of NPR's special programming on the war in the Gulf. Today's program features interviews from our archives. Coming up, an interview with the Duke's son. Mercer Ellington tells us about conducting the Duke Ellington Orchestra. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has again condemned the Iraqi missile attack on Israel. At a news conference today, Mr. Bush also urged the country not to expect the war to be won overnight, saying we will prevail, but the effort will take time. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has more.
We're 37 hours into this, and so far so good, the president told reporters this afternoon. But he quickly changed his tone. He cautioned Americans not to be too euphoric. There will be losses, he said, and if we want to minimize casualties, this effort will take time. The president also said that the initial goals have not changed, referring to last night's Iraqi missile attack of Israel. Secretary of State Baker has spoken with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, urging him not to respond to the missile attack. The president said Israel doesn't want the war to be widened either, and he was skeptical about Saddam's ability to split up the Arab Western force. President Bush said he appreciates Israel's restraint, and he said he could guarantee that as every hour goes by, Iraq will be less able to withstand the attack. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
The Soviet Union has condemned last night's Iraqi missile attack on Israel as an effort to escalate the Persian Gulf War and called on Israel not to strike back. A Soviet diplomat also said that diplomatic channels to Iraq are being kept open in hopes that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein will respond to a message sent by Soviet leader Gorbachev. A Soviet official also said that his country made a mistake in equipping Iraq with Scud missiles. Two air raid signals were heard again today in Israel, and both were apparently false alarms. The second was heard after a fiery object was spotted in the sky, which Israeli radio later reported was caused by a Soviet satellite re-entering the Earth's atmosphere. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem that residents are making preparations for a long stay inside.
People are not supposed to leave their houses, and if they do have to leave, they're supposed to carry their gas masks with them. Earlier today, the army said that people could go out between 10:30 and 2:30 to go and buy food if they needed, and many people went out. I was in a supermarket earlier today that was absolutely jammed, and people looked like they were stocking up. Many stores were out of bread and milk, and there was a slight edge of panic as people sort of started running around from store to store trying to find bread and trying to find milk. I was walking home with a bag of milk, and an old man congratulated me and said, "Oh, good for you. You got some milk," as if it was a major achievement.
NPR's Linda Gradstein reporting from Jerusalem. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 23 points to close at 2,646.78 on volume of some 227 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 4-3. This is NPR News. Officials in Greece have asked the Iraqi embassy in Athens to cut its staff to 7 from the present 30 people. Officials told the 23 Iraqi diplomats to get out of the country if they can find transportation. A government spokesman also said that Greece may act if Turkey comes under Iraqi attack. In Washington, President Bush has issued a new executive order extending active duty time of military reservists involved in the Persian Gulf War for up to 2 years. The order also empowered the Pentagon to activate up to 1 million reservists if needed. In Los Angeles, Spanish-speaking volunteers are offering support to those who do not speak English and have family and friends serving in the Persian Gulf. Kitty Feldy of station KLON reports.
Grupo de apoyo para la familia militar, le ayudo.
Bertha Sanchez has been on the phone for hours, answering questions from concerned family members whose loved ones are in the Middle East. When the bombs began to fall, Sanchez persuaded fellow counselors and social workers to volunteer their time to counsel military families who don't speak English. Sanchez, who has two sons herself serving in the Gulf, says she started the support group to keep from going crazy.
I know that if I help someone else, God's going to help my boys.
The group, Support for Latino Military Families, offers information about free fax service for letters and free one-on-one or group counseling in Spanish. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Los Angeles.
Jordan has opened its border again with Iraq for an expected hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing the war over Iraq and Kuwait. Earlier, Syrian sources had said that the Syrian border with Iraq, closed since 1980, would also be open to refugees. Jordan has also reopened its airport in Amman for a 20-hour shutdown for security reasons. I'm Ann Taylor, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Beginning Monday, Fresh Air will be part of NPR special programming on the war in the Gulf. But today, expanded news coverage is preempting us on many stations around the country, so we're featuring interviews from our archives. This is an interview recorded in 1989 with Mercer Ellington. We're listening to Mercer Ellington's composition, Danish Eyes, with Mercer conducting the Duke Ellington Orchestra on the recent recording, Music is My Mistress. Much of Mercer's life has been spent working with the Ellington Orchestra. As a young man, he was the gopher. In 1950, he played briefly with the orchestra, and in 1964, he rejoined as a trumpeter and road manager. Mercer also wrote several compositions that became a part of the orchestra's repertoire, including Things Ain't What They Used to Be, Blue Surge, and Jumpin' Pumpkins. He's conducted the orchestra since his father's death in 1974. It must have been difficult for Mercer to establish his own musical identity, growing up in the shadow of one of America's greatest composers. I asked if his father's death helped liberate Mercer as a composer.
You would think that it would have, but that's not true, really. I'm under the same restriction as far as competition is concerned. Competition with myself, early Mercer Ellington, and competition, with Duke Ellington, with the same problem he had. The things that he's written are so perennial that all our audiences request many of the tunes from the past, and they have such a great warmth and a great charm that you have to do them. And, you know, can you imagine us doing a concert, say, without playing Satin Doll or Mood Indigo or Sophisticated Ladies?
When your father was alive and you wrote a composition, something like, say, Things Ain't What They Used to Be, would he listen to it and then critique it for you?
No. In fact, it was funny you should pick that particular tune, because he called me up. He knew I was out in the street playing around, and he laid for me. He had the clerk in the hotel to give him a ring when I came in, which is about 4:30. And I had been complaining because I wasn't getting the opportunity to write anything and do anything about it. So he waited, and at 4:30 he called me and says, we have a session at 9 o'clock. I want you to do a side for me. I just reached for everything and anything I could find and threw it out there at him. And I've been trying to write like that ever since.
What was his reaction to it when he heard it?
His reaction was always, his compliment was always silence. His negative reaction was a suggestion. Well, you might have done this, or do you think this is possible, or whatever. And much as was the case with him as an individual, to bring him to a point of decision or to get him to make an absolute statement called for a certain kind of treatment that you had to give him. I'd be in the dither as to how to get from one town to the other, whether to charter the bus, whether we should fly or take the train. If I asked him what should I take, I'd never get an answer. So my way of invoking a decision from him would be, well, Pop, tomorrow we're going to get up at 9 o'clock and take the train out to Philadelphia. And he'd say, well, what's wrong with the airplane? Then I knew we could fly.
You played in the Ellington Band. Did
yes.
You? How long did you play?
I was with them for 1 year in 1950 left to form a record company. And then again, I joined them in 1967 to state.
Did you have to audition to get in?
No. I guess the word is con my way into the orchestra. When I got in there as a trombone player, they were very short of musicians because the business was so good, everybody who was a soloist could have his own band. But later, he needed a road manager. And all his friends had turned him down because they said they wanted to remain his friend. And the last man he could think of was me, so he called me up and said, I want you to be the road manager. I knew what trouble he'd had in trying to find someone. I said, yeah, I'll do it, on the proviso that I play trumpet as I do the road manager. So he put me in as a fifth wheel. Actually, I was a fifth wheel. There were five trumpets there at the time.
And that's how you became the road manager, too?
Right.
You ended up being the manager of a band where you knew all the musicians since your childhood. And
which is the worst handicap you can have.
Yeah, because they probably thought of you as the kid, even though you weren't the kid anymore.
And it wasn't that so much. It was just one of those things. They thought of me as the gopher. That was my first job.
So you'd have to run out and get stuff.
For, yeah, and I still have it. I have every job left that I started out with. I still go get the sandwiches. I help with the baggage. I help set up the bandstand. I have to do the copying and also make arrangements.
So how did you gain respect and a sense of authority when you became the road manager?
Never did get any respect, I guess. You talk about Rodney Dangerfield. It was one of those things where, you know, you just hung in there long enough to be accepted. And I think this is the main thing. We had people who joined the band and quit because they'd come in for weeks and nobody even say good morning to them. There were no two men that hung out with each other in that orchestra except Barnaby Gard and Ben Webster.
You know, it's so hard to imagine that because hearing the orchestra, it's such a really gorgeous unit. And to think of everybody squabbling all the time when they weren't playing is, you know.
Well, I used to call them the Yankees. You know, they were all great musicians and they could play wonderfully together. And they argued like mad, but whenever the weight dropped, I mean, they could come in and they would do the job.
Was it understood when your father was getting older that you would take over the band after he died?
Absolutely not. I mean, it never occurred to him. It never occurred to me. Only thing, if it had occurred to me, I would have studied piano much more seriously than I did. But all I cared about was getting into the orchestra. And I knew if I played piano, that wouldn't happen.
We're listening to an interview with Mercer Ellington from the Fresh Air Archives. It was recorded in 1989. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Mercer Ellington is my guest, and he's conducted the Duke Ellington Orchestra since Mercer's father's death in 1974. Can you tell us what a rehearsal would be like with Duke Ellington?
Well, first off, the 2 o'clock rehearsal got started around about 3:15, and then the guys would come in, they would put down the music, and start playing it. And it would sound like the worst thing in the world by the third playing of it. It took on a sound which was completely different and completely identifiable as something that could only be Duke Ellington. And it depended on what he thought of it and what the purpose of what he was rehearsing was for. Many times, for no reason at all, he would rehearse a tune and spend 5 or 6 hours on just one number. And on another occasion, he would just play the number twice and find that the engineers didn't get it properly if we were in a record date. And then he declared, well, okay, that's enough time on that, because now the feeling is gone. And the soloist can't come up with the same emotion that he had on the first time of playing it. So he'd abandon it until we got to the next studio and next rehearsal, go over it again, studio, rehearsal, until one day he decided, well, now we got the one that's right. So that a rehearsal with Ellington was never something that was like systematic or that you knew there would be some form of methodology that would be called for.
You are, with the Duke Ellington Orchestra, playing some of Ellington's neglected works, some of the extended works, as well as some of his most popular compositions. When you take out a work that hasn't been played in a long time and you're looking at the score, is it difficult to read? And I ask you that because in a memoir that you wrote about your father, Duke Ellington, you say that he frequently wrote really cryptically because he was afraid that people would steal his composition, which was, I guess, pretty common then, that people would steal other people's ideas. So he'd write it so it couldn't be stolen that easily. Are you stuck with having to decipher that now?
No, not really, because I did so much copying that I recognized his symbols and all the little things he did to disguise the music. For instance, one of them would be to write a part and put the wrong clef sign on it. So if somebody had started naming the notes, they'd have it completely messed up. The other thing was to use, this cryptic titling on numbers so that if you heard a number and you wanted to get it out of the book, like, for instance, you know, he'd make an arrangement that would say a new concept of In My Solitude, you'd never find it. If you wanted to say, you did a tune called Squeeze Me. Well, on one occasion, it would be titled Slew Slew. And then another time he called it Subtle Slough. So if you looked in the in the music to try to, say, take the parts out and copy them over or get some kind of idea of what was happening, you couldn't recognize the tune by the writing that was on it. Well, because the saxophones had one name on it and the trombones had another, and you could never really piece them together.
So how common was stealing through sheet music?
Well, in days, I mean, it was very blatant at one point. And even in the old Cotton Club days, the guys from downtown would come in with their pencils in their hands and just blatantly sit there with the music and sit in the front row copying down what they heard.
It's amazing. In Music Is My Mistress, your father's collection of memoirs and reminiscences about musicians, He wrote a couple of pages about you, and he started it by saying, "My son Mercer Ellington is dedicated to maintaining the luster of his father's image." Did you ever feel that he perhaps took that for granted?
No, but what he's doing, in essence, he was saying something in print that he could never say to me individually. And it was not necessarily meant for the reader as much as it was meant for me, because he had the difficulty of being able to talk intimately to me. I have the same difficulty. And if I had to say to my wife or my children or something else that they did something I liked, I'd find it difficult to make the statement. I think this was his way of expressing approval of what of many of the things I had done, or saying thanks for having done it.
Do you have any of your father's show business superstitions? He had a lot of superstitions.
Oh, he's gotten us all, you know, a place where we've been brainwashed. And when it gets down to it, there were only two colors which he really, allowed, and that was blue and white. And then once in a while, he allowed a little red to come in. I guess maybe that had to do with his patriotism. But you dare not whistle in the dressing room, nor bring in a newspaper, nor peanuts. And he hated green. Green was always bad luck to him.
Where do these things come from? Do you have any idea?
Well, it came related to experiences. He hated green, and he hated brown because he was wearing a brown suit the day his mother died.
Oh.
And so he had a reason behind it, an experience to relate to.
So would you wear brown now?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, okay.
I wear green. He however, did not object to green on the back of dollar bills.
Since so many people know you as the son of Duke Ellington, are people surprised when they find out
that you're getting older yourself. You were born in 1919. Do you know what I mean? I think in a lot of people's eyes, you're going to be just perpetually very young.
Ellington has caused a tremendous oversight on my age for quite a while. In the old days, he used to say he didn't want anyone to know he had a son with gray hair because it might keep the chicks away. And then he's still at it even as of now, because I told people, and we had quite a do, you know, in this past month, celebrating his 90th birthday. And so they all got to where, they, you know, we got around and took care of each other and everything like that. And all of a sudden they said something about, well, you shouldn't be tired. I explained to them, I said, you know, you've all been so busy celebrating Duke Ellington's 90th birthday that you've forgotten that I'm on my 70th. And I'd like to get some sleep for a change.
Mercer Ellington, I thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you very much for joining us on
Fresh Air. It's been very pleasant, Terry.
Mercer Ellington has conducted the Duke Ellington Orchestra since Duke's death in 1974. This interview from the Fresh Air Archives was originally broadcast shortly after Duke Ellington's 90th birthday celebration in May of 1989. This is Duke Ellington conducting the orchestra in a 1957 recording of Duke Ellington's Prelude to a Kiss. This is Fresh Air. Wars generate their own vocabulary. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg talked about that just a couple of days ago, but his commentary was preempted in many places by Bullinen's announcing the start of the war in the Gulf.
Who first said that history repeats itself? Some people credit Hegel, but Montaigne made the same observation, and so did Plutarch, and so did Thucydides. One thing is sure, it was Marx who added that history repeats itself twice, the first time as tragedy and the second as farce. In this, as in so many things, Marx was an optimist. History doesn't stop at a second run-through. After the farce is played out, it returns as etymology. Take the word jingoism, which denotes a belligerent nationalism. The word encapsulates the whole history of British imperialism. It originated in 1878 in the political crisis over what the British called the Eastern Question. The Bulgarians had rebelled against their Turkish masters. The Turks suppressed the rising with terrible massacres and atrocities. Then the Tsar declared war on the Turkish Sultan in the name of his oppressed Slavic brethren. The English had been watching Russia warily since the Crimean War of the 1850s. That bloody exercise accomplished nothing. But it did enrich the English language. It gave us Tennyson's Charge of the Light Brigade, not to mention the Raglan Sleeve and the Cardigan Sweater, which were named after the commanders who had ordered the brigade to glorious slaughter at the Russian batteries at Balaclava. Along with Wellington boots and the Eisenhower jacket, they remind us of the great debt that haberdashery owes to generals. Back to 1878. As the Tsar's troops advanced on Constantinople, the British prepared to go to war with Russia again. Queen Victoria told Prime Minister Disraeli she felt she couldn't remain the sovereign of a country that was letting itself down to kiss the feet of the great barbarians. Pro-war mobs took to the streets. They broke the windows of the house of opposition leader William Gladstone, who wanted Britain to side with the Christian Bulgarians against the Turks. As their anthem, they took the words of a popular music hall song, "We don't want to fight, but by jingo if we do, we've got the men, we've got the ships, we've got the money too." The pro-war party came to be called the Jingos or Jingoists. Disraeli sent a British fleet to the Dardanelles, but war was averted when the sides signed a treaty at the Congress of Berlin in June of 1878. The Russians got a couple of slices of Turkish territory, and the Turks got Bulgaria back after promising to treat the Christians more kindly. Britain, which hadn't fired a shot, got the island of Cyprus. Disraeli described the outcome with another phrase that would enter the language as peace with honor. But the British public was having second thoughts about selling out the Bulgarians. The affair became an issue in the 1880 elections, when Disraeli was turned out in favor of Gladstone, though that result may have owed as much to a national recession. Gladstone was less bellicose than Disraeli, but that proved in turn to be his political undoing. In 1882, the celebrated General Gordon got himself besieged at Khartoum by the armies of the Islamic holy man known as the Mahdi. The jingoist resurfaced, by now a common noun, demanding that a relief force be sent. But Gladstone hesitated, unwilling to sacrifice British lives for a territory so remote and inhospitable. The relief force reached Khartoum 3 days too late to save General Gordon. Gladstone's government was discredited and turned out of office. Gordon's death was not avenged until 15 years later, when General Kitchener led an expedition that reconquered the Sudan and killed the Mahdi and 10,000 of his men. It was a famous victory, but its only contribution to English literature was Kipling's Fuzzy Wuzzy, which is hardly in a class with the Charge of the Light Brigade. Neither Gordon nor Kitchener left his name on an article of clothing. Linguistically, the Pacific Mr. Gladstone probably came off best of anyone. The Gladstone bag is a suitcase divided into hinged compartments, a nice place to stow your kit when cooler heads prevail.
Linguist Jeff Nunberg. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we begin a series of special programs on the war in the Gulf. We'll bring you news, a historical context for today's events, and reflections on war. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.